paper on the word of wisdom will be responded to by Kenneth Godfrey, who currently is instructing at the Institute at the Utah State University. Dr. Alexander.
Those who've studied the word of wisdom recognize that the current emphasis is of rather recent vintage, pun intended. Church leaders did not expect abstinence from tea, coffee, liquor, and tobacco, currently required for active participation in the church's programs, including the holding of responsible offices and receiving a temple recommend, until the early 20th century, and did not enforce the requirement rigorously until Heber J. Grant's administration. This paper investigates the canonization of the Word of Wisdom as a requirement for active participation, the interaction between doctrinal interpretation and political and social forces, and the reasons for the current interpretation. Since the work of Paul Peterson, we have known a great deal about the public attitudes and practices of church leaders on the Word of Wisdom, revealed to Joseph Smith in 1833 as a principle with promise. Section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants came during a period both of increasing alcoholic consumption and increasing temperance sentiment. One historian has called the United States during the period an alcoholic republic. But at the same time, the Western Reserve area of Ohio, in which Kirtland was situated, was a hotbed of temperance sentiment. During the same period, reformers like Sylvester Graham promoted a health movement, which religious organizations and groups like the students and faculty of Oberlin College helped to support. In addition, the filth of tobacco chewing and the discomfort of tobacco smoke repelled church leaders and members. Currently available evidence indicates that adherence to the Word of Wisdom in the 19th century was sporadic. Joseph Smith interpreted the phrase hot drinks to mean tea and coffee about 5 months after he gave the revelation. At various times during the last century, resolutions were passed, advice and counsel given, and members were disfellowshipped or even excommunicated, at least in part, because of their failure to observe the Word of Wisdom. In general, however, adherence, in the sense of abstinence from tea, coffee, liquor, and tobacco, was honored as much in the breach as in the observance by leaders and members alike, particularly after 1840. Some members or groups committed themselves to strict adherence to the Word of Wisdom, but they were doing so as individuals bound to a principle with promise. Some writers have insisted that Brigham Young declared and secured approval of the saints to the proposition that the Word of Wisdom be considered a commandment. The date 1851, or some other conference address or reminiscence of an address, is often cited. Currently available evidence, however, indicates that while in 1851 a conference voted to observe the Word of Wisdom, and Brigham Young often advised its adherence then and at other times, there seems to be no instance of a general conference of the church voting to make the Word of Wisdom binding upon all church members. During Brigham Young's lifetime, breaches of the Word of Wisdom continued by himself and by others in the church. Re-emphasis on the Word of Wisdom in the late 1860s and early 1870s seems to have been more closely related to the larger effort to discourage imports than to the health aspects of the principle. From the death of Brigham Young until after the turn of the century, adherence was intermittent. In 1833 and 1834, the general authorities, following the lead of John Taylor, emphasized the need to adhere to the Word of Wisdom. Thereafter, it seems to have generally lain dormant. The status of the Word of Wisdom at the turn of the 20th century seems evident from contemporary sources. At a meeting on May 5, 1898, the First Presidency and 12 discussed the Word of Wisdom. One member read from the 12th volume of the Journal of Discourses a statement by Brigham Young that the Word of Wisdom was a commandment of God. Lorenzo Snow, then president of the Council of the Twelve, agreed, saying that he believed the Word of Wisdom was a commandment and that it should be carried out to the letter. In doing that, he said, members should be taught to refrain from eating meat except in dire necessity, particularly since Joseph Smith had taught that animals have spirits. Wilford Woodruff, then president of the church, said he looked upon the Word of Wisdom as a commandment and that all members should observe it. But for the present, he said, no definite action should be taken except the members should be taught to refrain from the eating of meat. The minutes of the meeting record that, quote, President Woodruff said he regarded the word of wisdom in its entirety as given of the Lord to the Latter-day Saints to observe, but he did not think that bishops should withhold recommends from persons who did not adhere strictly to it. Though it seems clear that some general authorities, particularly Heber J. Grant and Joseph F. Smith, insisted upon complete abstinence from tea, coffee, liquor, and tobacco, all general authorities did not agree. During a discussion in 1900, after he became president of the church, Lorenzo Snow again emphasized the centrality of not eating meat, and in 1901, John Henry Smith and Brigham Young, Jr. of the 12, thought the church ought not to interdict beer, or at least not Danish beer. Other apostles, like Anthony H. Lund and Matthias F. Cowley, enjoyed Danish beer and currant wine. Charles W. Penrose occasionally served wine. Emmeline B. Wells, then a member of the presidency and later president of the Relief Society, drank an occasional cup of coffee, and George Albert Smith took brandy for medicinal reasons. Elder George Teasdale agreed with President Woodruff and thought that no one ought to be kept from working in the Sunday school because he drank tea and that eating pork was a more serious breach than drinking tea or coffee. Currently available evidence, then, indicates a diffuse pattern in observing and teaching the word of wisdom in 1900. Some general authorities preached quite consistently against the use of tea, coffee, liquor, or tobacco, and occasionally against the use of meat. None supported drunkenness. In practice, however, they and other members of the church also occasionally drank the beverages, which our current interpretation would prohibit. Observance of the word of wisdom was urged by way of counsel by President Snow and others. Some apostles, like John Henry Smith, believed that some of the 12 were overzealous in their opposition to beer. He believed that the more important question was one of free agency, and that those who continued to insist upon strict adherence to the word of wisdom were ignoring this more important principle. President Snow also opposed sanctions against the use of alcohol and was upset when the General Board of the YMMIA asked for an end to the sale of beer at Salt Air. Most vocal among general authorities in his opposition to the use of tea, coffee, alcohol, and tobacco was Elder Heber J. Grant, who would become one of the principal leaders of the state prohibition movement. He was particularly outraged at members of the church who served liquor and at some of the 12 who opposed the prohibition of liquor at Salt Air. He was also concerned at the indifference of some of the general authorities to the feelings of Protestant ministers who complained about the saloon at Salt Air. The death of Lorenzo Snow brought Joseph F. Smith to the presidency, whose views on the word of wisdom were close to those of Heber J. Grant. It is from his administration that the path to our current interpretation of the word of wisdom leads. Dropping the emphasis on the abstinence of meat, he urged the need to refrain from the use of tea, coffee, alcohol, and tobacco. In 1902, he reversed President Snow's stand and closed the saloon at Salt Air, a move which the Protestant clergy heartily approved. Apparently following this lead, in June 1902, the First Presidency and 12 agreed not to fellowship anyone who operated or frequented saloons. In the same year, Joseph F. Smith urged stake presidents and others to refuse recommends to flagrant violators, but to be somewhat liberal with old men who used tobacco and old ladies who drank tea. Habitual drunkards, however, were to be denied temple recommends. Under these conditions, it was clear that the general authorities were moving toward current policy and practice. By mid-1905, members of the 12 were using state conference visits actively to promote adherence. In September 1905, for instance, George Albert Smith advised the state presidency, high council, and bishops in Star Valley, Wyoming, to refuse, quote, to longer tolerate men in presiding positions who would not keep the word of wisdom. George F. Richards preferred to take the position of interviewing and urging compliance rather than insisting on lack of toleration. In keeping with the change in emphasis, the First Presidency and 12 substituted water for wine in the sacrament in their temple meetings, apparently beginning on July the 5th, 1906. After 1906, a strong prohibition movement developed in the United States, centered in evangelical Protestant groups. In 1906, only Iowa, Kansas, and Maine had statewide prohibition.
But by 1919, 26 states, principally in the Midwest, Far West, South, and Upper New England, had adopted this reform. Although increasing scientific evidence on the adverse effects of alcohol helped the movement, moral rather than scientific consideration seemed to have sustained the prohibition movement. The period between 1911 and 1915 represented the post-Civil War apogee of alcoholic consumption in the United States, and the fear of moral decay, broken homes, and wasted fortunes fueled the prohibition movement here. As indicated above, the Latter-day Saints were already working internally before 1906 to oppose the consumption of alcoholic beverages and to interdict the use of tea, coffee, tobacco among members. The interpretations given by 19th century leaders to the Word of Wisdom provided part of the basis for this emphasis within the church. Another important motive for those on all sides of the question seems to have been the desire for national acceptance. Strongest opposition to the seating of B.H. Roberts and Reed Smoot had come from evangelical Protestant groups, and some leaders, like Elder Grant, were particularly sensitive to the feelings of those groups. In addition, the strongest support for state and later nationwide prohibition among church members was found among Democrats and progressive Republicans. They were searching for acceptance by church members who were increasingly pressured to vote the regular Republican ticket in support of Reed Smoot and his federal bunch, and for national approval by Protestants who had so long opposed the church. Among Federal Bunch Republicans, however, the situation was much different. Generally in control of the legislature, the governorship, and the congressional and senatorial seats until 1916, Smoot supporters were reluctant to upset their majority position by alienating members of the business community sympathetic to the liquor traffic, or by creating a climate congenial to anti-Mormon political parties. The organization of the statewide prohibition movement in Utah began in December 1907 when the Reverend Dr. George W. Young of Louisville, Kentucky, Assistant General Superintendent of the Anti-Saloon League of the United States, came to Utah. Throughout early 1908, the League organized its three departments, agitation, legislation, and law enforcement, in Utah, and Heber J. Grant took an early interest in the movement, became a trustee in Utah, and an officer of the national organization. In the late fall and early winter of 1908, the Reverend Dr. Lewis S. Fuller, superintendent of the Anti-Saloon League for Utah and Idaho, met with members of the First Presidency, the 12, and with Elder Grant. They agreed to support a local option bill in the 1909 legislature. Initially, prohibition had wide support within the church. Edward H. Anderson expressed surprise in January 1908 in an article in the Improvement Era that Utah was still one of the completely wet states. He thought that, quote, the Latter-day Saints will unitedly and enthusiastically join in bringing about the liquor traffic's complete extermination. A number of the 12 met with members of an organization called the Salt Lake City Betterment Committee and agreed to implement a resolution which had been passed in the October 1907 General Conference to do all in their power to stop the liquor traffic. As Anthony H. Lund, second counselor in the First Presidency, said, this means prohibition. At a Temple Fast meeting in January of 1908, Richard W. Young, president of the Ensign Stake, and Joseph F. Smith both endorsed prohibition. A number of factors, however, lead to the conclusion that church leaders should support local option or even oppose public action on the liquor question rather than to favor prohibition. William Spry, John Henry Smith, and a number of Republican leaders were concerned that prohibition would not prohibit and that the law would subject property to confiscation. Some, like Francis M. Lyman, urged individual regeneration rather than prohibition, though he later changed to favor prohibition. Perhaps the most important pressure against prohibition came from Gentile Republicans, particularly businessmen whose interests included liquor manufacture or sales. Fred J. Kiesel, for instance, said that it would be a political blunder to support statewide prohibition. After June 1908, the Intermountain Republican, church-owned organ of Reed Smoot's federal bunch, stopped publishing articles favorable to prohibition, and the Republican Party dumped John C. Cutler, partly because of his support of statewide prohibition, in favor of William Spry, who was nominally in support of local option. At the time the legislature met in January 1909, the church leadership was moving in two directions. Now, Francis M. Lyman, by now converted to prohibition, called Bishop John M. Whitaker to work with the legislature and with Elder Grant, Presiding Bishop Charles W. Nibley, and others who favored prohibition. The Deseret News published articles and interviews favoring prohibition. President Joseph F. Smith, Reed Smoot, and others, more sensitive to political problems, however, became equivocal in their support. Reed Smoot said he believed that the prohibition movement would hurt the church by bringing further charges of church influence in politics. John Henry Smith opposed prohibition, but considered Reed Smoot's objection somewhat hypocritical, since the apostle senator, quote, had not objected to priesthood influence when he wanted to be elected. Then, he said, all the Gentiles honored was power. Eventually, the legislature sidetracked a prohibition bill introduced by non-Federal Bunch Republican George M. Cannon in favor of a local option bill sponsored by Smoot's lieutenant, Carl A. Badger. Though the Badger bill passed, William Spry pocket vetoed it to the chagrin of many supporters. In 1911, however, the legislature revived and passed the Badger local option bill. This time, Spry signed it. The fight over prohibition between 1911 and 1917 was almost a replay of the local option battle between 1908 and 1911. The Republican church leaders, closely allied to the Federal Bunch, favored prohibition in public but were equivocal in private. Fear of a backlash against the church, which might lead to the creation of a new anti-Mormon party, and fear of alienating Gentile businessmen from the Republican Party seemed to have been the principal motives. In 1915, Spry pocket vetoed a widely supported statewide prohibition bill. By 1916, the majority of the Republican Party could no longer support Spry, and Nephi L. Morris, a president of the Salt Lake State, Progressive Party gubernatorial candidate in 1912, and avid prohibitionist, received the Republican Party nomination but lost the election. By that time, virtually all church leaders and a large majority of all Utah citizens also supported prohibition, and Democratic Governor Simon Bamberger and the democratically controlled legislature enacted statewide prohibition in 1917. In the meantime, emphasis on the word of wisdom during Joseph F. Smith's administration continued essentially as it was formulated in 1902. In a letter dated December 28, 1915, President Smith essentially reasserted what he'd said in 1902. After 1917, of course, we had prohibition, and the church began to emphasize the need for political measures to deal with tobacco. A law was passed in 1921, which didn't work very well, and it was repealed in 1923, an anti-tobacco law. Between 1921 and 1933, the requirement of adherence to the Word of Wisdom for full fellowship in the church was made even more explicit. And in the 1933 General Handbook of Instructions, the members desiring recommends were told, quote, they should observe the law of tithing. The applicant should also observe all other principles of the gospel, should keep the word of wisdom, not use profanity, should not join nor be a member of any secret oath-bound organization, and should sustain without reservation the general and local authorities of the church. After that time, church members began to move in other directions to deal with a number of problems. During the 1920s, they were particularly concerned about the problem of enforcement of the prohibition laws, and they put a great deal of effort into trying to do those things to see that prohibition was enforced in the state. Although the church leadership continued to fight to maintain prohibition, Utah became the 39th state to vote for repeal of the 18th Amendment and thus to seal the end of prohibition. Church leaders were not uniform in their assessment of the experiment. Heber J. Grant was very upset that Utahns had not followed his counsel to retain prohibition. Joseph Fielding Smith said that with all its abuses and corruption, prohibition was nevertheless a boon to society, and it would be a calamity of the gravest kind to repeal or modify it now. B.H. Roberts, however, favored repeal, and Anthony W. Ivins, first counselor in the first presidency, questioned its usefulness. He pointed out that enforcement had cost more than $500 million by 1931, with which, he thought, the country could have constructed 100,000 miles of paved road or endowed 500 colleges with $1 million each. In addition to liquor, tobacco, tea, and coffee, some members of the church urged that the prohibition in the Word of Wisdom ought to be much broader. And I've dealt in the paper here with a number of things, including prohibiting the use of Coca-Cola, which was a controversial matter then, prohibiting the use of refined flour and various things of that sort. And I'd like to conclude here by tying the thing together by dealing with in a general way, with the reasons for all of this. What role did Revelation play in the matter? It's clear that Section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants was given as a revelation to Joseph Smith. Advice to the members of the church to adhere to the Word of Wisdom was also undoubtedly given under inspiration. There is, however, no contemporary evidence of which I'm aware that a revelation was given changing the Word of Wisdom from a principle with promise to a commandment necessary for full participation in all the blessings of church membership. One author on the subject has argued that the vote in an 1880 conference sustaining the Doctrine and Covenants as binding on the church membership was equivalent to a vote making the Word of Wisdom a commandment. If, however, the members were voting on the words contained in the book, what they did was to agree that the Word of Wisdom was a principle with promise, not that it was a commandment. It's obvious that the 12 and First Presidency gave prayerful consideration to the conclusion that the Word of Wisdom ought to be considered a commandment binding upon church members. Nevertheless, the major problem in interpreting the influence of Revelation in these deliberations is the absence of references to revelations or even spiritual confirmations of the specific positions in the diaries of those who participated in the meetings. The references are rather to statements or reminiscences of statements by previous authorities, and even here it seems to have been no discussion of new revelations to Brigham Young or other church leaders who preceded them. In sum, it is much easier to find references to previous statements than to see the presence of new revelation. The inclusion of coffee and tea and the exclusion of cocoa, for instance, from the prohibited substances can probably be attributed to statements of Joseph and Hiram Smith and Brigham Young rather than to specific revelations. Other influences are easier to document. Elder Grant's diary reveals the influence of evangelical Protestant sentiment in his attitude toward liquor and tobacco. These attitudes had begun to develop in the United States in church and business sectors as early as the 1830s. The nationwide temperance movement of the 1830s and the prohibition movement of the early 20th century were linked to evangelical attitudes. Utahns in general, and Mormons in particular, were rather late additions to the prohibition movement rather than its early leaders. The influence of the attitude of these groups is easiest to see when one contrasts the insistence on abstinence of liquor and tobacco with the rather tolerant attitude toward the use of meat. The sources of political attitudes related to the Word of Wisdom are also rather evident. Few of the general authorities seem to have opposed the use of the state to enforce the moral code, and though some opposed the use of legal sanctions to enforce health restrictions like vaccination, Elder Grant believed in the use of state power to regulate the quality of milk and to control tuberculosis. He and many others also supported public sanctions against the use of alcohol and tobacco. The political sources of the attitudes of Reed Smoot and Joseph F. Smith in the period before 1916 are also evident. Both feared tearing apart the Republican Party and the possible rebirth of a new anti-Mormon party from the ashes of the old liberal and American parties. By 1916, however, public sentiment was so strongly in favor of prohibition that such fears were secondary to their religious beliefs, which insisted upon adherence to the Word of Wisdom. How, then, does one draw together these influences to understand what happened during the period under consideration? Public and private statements indicate that the church leaders were concerned about the moral tone of the community in which they lived. In an attempt to improve that tone, they sought guidance from scriptures and from statements of earlier leaders. They gave prayerful consideration to both sources in determining their course of action. In addition, contemporary political and social movements, like the prohibition and anti-tobacco movements, seem to them to offer help in solving the problems they perceive in the community. It was thus the confluence of a number of forces, religious and secular, rather than a single force, which led to the current interpretation of the Word of Wisdom. The decisions made under the confluence of these forces have had an important long-range effect, since nothing, with the possible exception of the wearing of temple garments, serves to distinguish Latter-day Saints from the larger community more than does the Word of Wisdom today. An understanding of the way in which the current interpretation of the Word of Wisdom developed is significant also, since it provides a case study of the usual method of doctrinal and policy development within the Church. In those cases in which we have detailed information on such development, evidence seems to suggest that the change has ordinarily come about through the prayerful consideration over time of contemporary problems in the context of tradition, including previous scriptures and statements, immediate concerns, including political, social, and economic problems, and alternative courses of action. Other examples of similar patterns for which we have good documentation include the decision to locate in Utah, the current welfare plan, and even the doctrines of God and man. Thus, the student of Latter-day Saint doctrinal and policy development will provide a more thorough picture if he conceives his task broadly rather than providing the narrow context often taken of looking at scriptures and public statements. If a study of the interpretation of the Word of Wisdom can tell us anything, it is that such change does not take place in a vacuum. Thank you.
This excellent paper exemplifies Tom's scholarship, research, and the contribution he's beginning to make towards an understanding of Mormon theology. His findings answer many questions regarding the development of the Word of Wisdom and how we got to where we are today. I commend him for his illuminating treatment regarding the influence of Prohibition, the Protestant ministers, and evangelical Protestant groups on 20th century Mormon leaders. He is also to be commended for having researched and written an outstanding paper on a difficult topic. His paper represents a balanced treatment of what was and what some would think should have been. I did find, however, that his research had an intoxicating, if I may use the term without being accused of punning, effect upon me, and I found myself wanting to know more regarding the subject under consideration. It is the duty of the historian, and Tom exemplifies the best of Mormon historians, to publish accounts of what has happened, together with coordinating and explaining past events. And even though Descartes sneeringly wrote that historians are people who spend a lifetime learning facts about life, which every illiterate serving maid knew well, still it is believed by most scholars that history can and does make a contribution to the academic world. On the other hand, it is the task of the theologian to study God and the relationship between him and the universe, as well as religious doctrine and other matters of divinity. This, I believe, is what separates the historian from the theologian. Tom is first and foremost an historian, and I believe his paper reflects his training and interest, and is perhaps weaker when confronting matters of divinity. Inasmuch as this is a theological convention, or at least a convention devoted to the study of theology, let me see if I can demonstrate what I mean. First, I believe he did not pay sufficient attention to the text upon which both his own conclusions and the conclusions of church leaders are based. It is agreed by all who call themselves faithful Mormons that section 89 of our current edition of the Doctrine and Covenants was given by God to his prophet, Joseph Smith. Many have argued and disputed the immediate catalyst that caused this theophany to occur, but few have questioned that God was indeed the inspirer of the document. It then becomes the task of the theologian to determine the content of the revelation that has resulted from the mind of the prophet meeting the mind of God. It is my understanding that scholars of the Doctrine and Covenants have concluded that the first four verses of section 89 were not a part of the text as given through Joseph Smith, but were rather an introduction penned by the prophet himself, who never claimed to have received those words from heaven. Thus one could make the argument that the Word of Wisdom really begins by saying, "Behold, verily thus saith the Lord unto you," which would in a sense make it a divine imperative from the moment it was written down. Furthermore, it would be helpful to know just why Joseph Smith penned an introduction that indicates the revelation was not to be considered a commandment, and just when that introduction became a part of the text. Perhaps one could contend that Joseph F. Smith and Heber J. Grant were just proclaiming the Lord's original intent when they interpreted it as a commandment. There was also some important punctuation added at some time by someone which altered the meaning of at least one verse in the 89th section. Thus, I would encourage scholars of the Word of Wisdom to first of all provide us with an accurate study of the text upon which we could then base our conclusions. Second, I was somewhat disappointed to find little religious justification in the material cited by Tom for living the Word of Wisdom. I'm not faulting Tom when I make this comment. I'm only saying that I would feel more comfortable if the reasons for the Word of Wisdom becoming a commandment were founded in theology rather than on reasons of health and politics. We as humans do many other things that are at least as unhealthy as breaking the Word of Wisdom, and no divine imperative is thundered down from heaven commanding restraint. So why just tobacco, liquor, tea, and coffee? A few years ago, while in graduate school, I was a member of a high priest quorum. One Sunday, the discussion was about the Word of Wisdom, and the teacher stated that people could not receive revelation from God if they violated it. Quickly, I raised my hand and boldly declared that Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, and a host of other leading figures in the early church had violated certain aspects of the Word of Wisdom. And did that mean the church has not been led by revelation for many years? I thought that was a fine question, setting smugly because I knew I could support my assertion with empirical data. I waited for an answer, only to hear a member of the state presidency declare that I was a liar, and then quickly bore his testimony to clinch the point. Later, I found myself wishing that the Word of Wisdom had been obeyed more faithfully by early leaders, and that the reason for its existence could be found in religious truth and not in a health book. I also found myself wishing that an entire generation had not been educated to believe that the principles found in the Word of Wisdom had always been stressed just as they are today, but had rather been given instructions such as Tom has given us today regarding its historical development. Still, I would hope that Tom or someone else would somehow discover evidence that the Word of Wisdom became a commandment because of sound theological reasons. Now let me turn to some other observations. In an address to the semiannual conference of the church in October 1909, Church President Joseph F. Smith declared, "Here we are informed that it, the Word of Wisdom, was not given at that time by way of commandment or constraint, but by revelation. Subsequently, years afterwards, from this stand, it was proclaimed from the mouth of the prophet and president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Brigham Young, that the time had now come when this Word of Wisdom, then not given by commandment or constraint, was now a commandment of the Lord, and the Lord required them to observe the Word of Wisdom, which is the will of God unto the people." We also find in 1853, in the minutes of the Salt Lake State School of the Prophets, the following entry. John Taylor said, "Some ask, what right had President Young to do this, make the Word of Wisdom a commandment? Just as much right as Joseph had to give a portion of a revelation at one time and then add to it afterwards." It would appear then from the words of these two church presidents that although there were Mormons who smoked, chewed, drank beer, and used tea and coffee for the next 60 years, still there were leading church officials who believed that such straying from the straight and narrow path constituted breaking a commandment of the Lord. Thus, while Tom's paper is a very valuable historical treatise regarding the way the Word of Wisdom came to be stressed, I am not certain that his evidence is convincing that this means it was not a divine imperative long before. I believe that his paper could be strengthened also if the author explored the effect priesthood advancement interviews, Sunday school lessons, MIA lessons, and priesthood lessons had in developing current attitudes toward the Word of Wisdom. I discovered, for example, that in 1912, Apostle David O. McKay, in an address to the general priesthood of the church, declared that every deacon should be instructed that an ordination to the priesthood carries with it a requirement of better habits and action, particularly in regard to language, smoking cigarettes, and using strong drink, and that such instruction should be an essential part of the bishop's interview. There must be other examples of this sort of instruction, which must have been as effective as the influence of prohibition and the ministers in helping the Word of Wisdom along the road to its becoming an article of faith. It would also have been instructive to have seen a review of the pamphlets that were authored to further encourage the saints to keep the Word of Wisdom. I discovered that at least five or six very effective ones were published in the church by the time Joseph F. Smith died and Heber J. Grant became the president of the church. I would also like to know how many ward teachers' messages and visiting teachers' messages were based on principles couched in the 89th section. I would also be interested to know if there were more general conference talks devoted to the Word of Wisdom during President Grant's administration than during the administration of Brigham Young, John Taylor, Lorenzo Snow, and Wilford Woodruff. It would, moreover, be instructive to know how much the attitudes of the general authorities called between 1898 and 1933 had upon the importance of keeping the word of wisdom. In just a very brief review of the apostles called during this period of time, I found that Hiram Mack Smith was publicly commended for having never tasted tea, coffee, liquor, or tobacco, as were Richard R. Lyman, George F. Richards, and John A. Widsoe. A more extended study of the men that were called to the apostleship during this era would be helpful. Tom whet my appetite, but did not fully answer why abstinence from meat, which was strongly supported by Church President Lorenzo Snow, has come largely to be ignored in our day. It would also be helpful to have a thorough treatment regarding the attitude of church leaders toward its cocoa, chocolate, and the cola drinks. I found that at least as early as 1902, church periodicals were condemning all of the above, together with tea and coffee, as being a poison to the human system and a part of the word of wisdom. Why did some of these foods become acceptable and tea and coffee unacceptable? Finally, as I indicated before, I believe this paper would be theologically stronger if Tom had been able to focus more strongly upon the religious and spiritual factors that may have motivated the church's leaders. Maybe he just wasn't able to find that. Maybe there isn't any there. I just kind of hope there was. While his paper is outstanding in explaining the environmental impact that made the word of wisdom a commandment, he does not do as well in clearing the air regarding the religious motivations that impelled Heber J. Grant and Joseph F. Smith, because I believe that both men saw themselves first and foremost as God's representatives and spokesmen upon the earth, and only secondarily as politicians and molders of public opinion. I think it's an excellent paper, and I do agree that there are many factors, as Tom did in his conclusion, that led us to the current interpretation, and I compliment him for doing a fine job on this topic.
I think we've had both an interesting paper and a good response, and we now invite questions from the floor, which you may address to either one of the speakers. Yes?
I just hope that, first of all, there might be a justification of having the word of wisdom become a commandment based on taking away man's basic free agency or something that was couched in theology along these lines. I felt that when Tom talked about it, that most of the influence or the reasons for it becoming stressed as it was were in prohibition or the criticisms of the ministers. I just hope somehow you could find a more compelling reason than that, because of the fact that the Lord hasn't told us not to overeat and a whole bunch of other things which may be more harmful to the body or as harmful as some of those other things, and that's all I meant by that. The second one, I thought it would be interesting, in as much as we are developing why we came to stress it the way we do today, to just see if there was more attention by the brethren paid to it in general conferences in President Grant's administration than there were in the previous administrations. I've read several conference talks which stressed it earlier, and I wondered if they were just increasing enforcing it or trying to develop the attitude of the saints so they would keep it, if it's proportionally stronger in Joseph F. Smith's administration, President Grant's, than it was previous, or if there were times in Lorenzo Snow's administration and Brigham Young's, which a number of conference talks were devoted to the word of wisdom. That's all I meant by that statement, I think, or that. And I didn't see that in the paper. I just thought it might have helped it if it had been there.
I checked with, Haber and Adams, who was then at the church archives, and he said that they had made a study of the Temple Recommend books. Haburn indicated that the first time that he saw it in the Temple Recommend book, where it was one of the questions that was to be asked, was 1921. Now, I also looked at the general handbooks of instruction over this period. Now, as you may know, during the early part of the period, those general handbooks of instructions were largely
advice, or I should say rules, for bishops, stake presidents, and stake tithing clerks on how they ought to administer tithing. Later, they become questions that are asked. I didn't find a question relating to the word of wisdom in the, check the date on that. I didn't read that part of the paper here. The 1928 General Handbook of Instructions simply had a general statement. It is important that all those who may desire to enter the temple for endowments or other ordinances should be encouraged by the bishopric to observe the principle of tithing as well as all other gospel principles. That kind of general statement. Then in 1933, there's the specific statement in the General Handbook of Instructions saying that the member should keep the word of wisdom in order to go to the temple. Now, I have had some evidence in the paper that this 1921 statement in the Temple Recommend book did have some effect. George F. Richards, in March of 1921, who was, in addition to being a member of the Council of the Twelve, was also president of the Salt Lake Temple, called up two bishops in Salt Lake, told them that two of their brethren who were coming to the temple were obviously using tobacco, and he said, and I'm quoting from his diary, to try to clean them up before they come here again. So that, as nearly as I can pinpoint it, as an absolute requirement, it happened sometime between 1921 and 1933. I'm not sure how strongly the bishops and stake presidents enforced it with that statement in the Temple Recommend book in 1921. I suspect with the statement in the General Handbook of Instructions, which would have been more public than a Temple Recommend book, it probably was enforced after 1933. Now, that's as close as I can come to answering that one. Now, the economic factor was undoubtedly important in his decision there, but you see, then Joseph F. Smith made the decision as soon as he became president in 1902 to close it down because of the pressure and the adverse criticism. There's one problem in this, and I didn't deal with it in the paper, in that the church received also considerable adverse criticism to the fact that there was a bar in the Hotel Utah during Joseph F. Smith's administration, and he simply didn't know how to deal with that problem. He took a kind of legalistic attitude toward that, that really isn't church property, because the church is one of the stockholders in it. It's a privately owned corporation, and a lot of other people own stock in it as well. That wasn't the case with Salt Air, which the church owned entirely, and which was leased to the saloon there was leased to a separate company. Now, what was your first question? Oh, okay, the 1853 statement. That's John Taylor's 1853 statement. I assume that what he's referring to there is the 1851 Brigham Young statement. That's what John Taylor's referring to in the 1853 School of the Prophet statement. Now, the problem with that is that what Brigham Young does on that occasion, he does say that the word of wisdom is a commandment. But what he secured approval of the congregation for was that they would observe the word of wisdom as a principle with promise. And he himself, after that time, broke the word of wisdom on occasion. And I find it difficult to assume that, given his performance after that time, and what the membership of the church seemed to have perceived him doing, that this was accepted by the church membership as a commandment. It was something that isn't the only time that he stated that. It was stated at other times by Brigham Young as well. And what I'm really dealing with here is a question of perception. That is, did the church membership in general perceive that as a commandment equal to other things that might be commanded of them? And I think that the answer to that is no, and that perception doesn't really take place until after the beginning of Joseph S. Smith's administration. So it's a question of perception, not actual words on the part of the church membership. Well, all I can do in answer to the second question is to refer to the material that I put together in the paper. It seems to me that at the basis of this whole reconsideration of the question of the word of wisdom was a desire to improve the moral tone of the community. Liquor consumption, the consumption of tobacco, were both on the upswing during that period. And the sources that we have indicate that in the period down to about 1915, the level of liquor consumption was higher than it was at any time since the Civil War throughout the United States. Discussions that are reported in the diaries of members of the Council of the Twelve in their meetings and comments that they make, particularly those like Heber J. Grant and George F. Richards and George Albert Smith, who were concerned about this matter, felt that it was a question of the moral tone of the community more than anything. And I suspect that they didn't feel that with regard to meat, that had very much to do with the moral tone of the community, and so it was simply generally left out of consideration, I think. I haven't found any evidence that was the case. It may well be, but I just didn't see it in any of the statements that they made, that argument was used against or in favor of meat prohibition. Now, as far as Joseph Smith having said anything about prohibition before the Word of Wisdom was issued, I don't know the answer to that. Perhaps Ken could comment on that, or someone else who's more familiar with Joseph Smith's early statements on it.
Perhaps I have a general question and exercise of prerogative, I guess, as a moderator. I'm interested in the theological implication, drawing in the Word of Wisdom as an example, one of which is similar to perhaps some others, the welfare plan you mentioned, perhaps the creation of the auxiliaries, the black policy, maybe ERA. It has to do with the nature of authoritative proclamations and whether or not they are given by commandment, by revelation, or perhaps by accreted tradition. We do not know, perhaps in the case of the Word of Wisdom, the origin in terms of divine revelation. We may or may not believe it was given in a particular manner. I guess my question is, do members of the church need to feel as bound by a position or policy that comes authoritatively but not through a specific revelation, as do they need to feel as bound by that as by a position that comes down authoritatively through a specific revelation? This is a theological question, I suppose, and I would be interested in a quick response from our two speakers.
Well, I think that this question really goes to the heart of the nature of revelation. And I think my position essentially is spelled out in the last two paragraphs of my paper, which I read to you. I don't believe that revelation comes in a vacuum. Here's what it generally does. I realize that there are some negative examples, such as the revelation of Christ to Paul on the road to Damascus, some other revelations of that sort, the revelation to Alma. But I think that generally, if we look at revelation over time in the church, it has been revelation which has come in response to a particular need. On the basis of consideration of a particular problem over time, growing out of something that's perceived, going to the Lord with a question, what ought to be done in this situation, in some cases asking for confirmation, whether a particular course of action is the course of action that ought to be taken. And I don't consider that any less revelation, in the sense that it's from God, binding upon church members, than another type of revelation which might come. And I would say that as far as the Word of Wisdom's concerned, the way in which that revelation was given during the early part of Joseph F. Smith's administration, which made the Word of Wisdom binding upon church members, would make it every bit as authoritative as any revelation which was given to Joseph Smith and published in the Doctrine and Covenants. It's not a question of receiving it as a bolt out of the sky, but whether that comes under inspiration from the Lord as a revelation to the church leaders and is accepted in that way.
I also think you can find some evidence in the diaries that right from the very beginning, when the word wisdom was given, 1833, that there were individuals in the church that considered adhering to the principles found therein as something that won them, at least in a sense, the goodwill of a God. And there are frequent diary entries all through this period in which individuals that are violating the word of wisdom still do not rejoice in the violation. You know, they are struggling to be able to keep it. And so I think even though it was during this period before maybe you're not able to go to the temple if you violate it, there were individuals all the way along that thought they would be blessed for having kept something that was revealed or given authoritatively earlier. And I guess even as our questionnaire said, if it was only based on health reasons, they still had the benefits of the good health that it brought about by adhering to it all the way along. And I agree with Tom that usually the prophet's revelations came in response to a need, and I think you can make an argument with scientific evidence that's available that saints maybe all the way along would have been much better had they kept it from 33 on and instead of waiting till 1933.
Thank you. I guess we won't be serving tea and coffee out in the hall after all. We'd now like to dismiss this session, and in 5 minutes we'll reconvene for the next session by Dr. Armin Moss.